Drive Time on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When it comes to pensions, performance counts. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Drive Time on RTE Radio 1.
Hamas launched a barrage of rockets and sent a wave of fighters who gunned down civilians.
A shocking hostage taking of more than 100 Israelis.
The military pounded the Palestinian enclave with airstrikes in the last 24 hours.
Now we argue about how many people are killed. I know the names of those people who were killed.
Hamas is using the houses of civilians in Gaza so he can shoot 1,000 missiles a day.
Electricity, food, water and gas supplies have been cut off.
Everything is running short, including the fuel for the generators.
Ask us, Israel, if we give our enemy fuel, they will abuse
it. They're fighting for war, they're fighting each other.
This is Israel's 9/11.
On October the 7th, Hamas militants stormed across the Israeli border with Gaza.
The attack killed 1,200 people and 251 were taken hostage.
In response, Israel launched a military bombardment of Gaza.
Palestinian health authorities say Israel's military campaign in Gaza has killed almost 42,000 people, mostly civilians over the past year, and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes.
Over four programmes will chronicle the year's events from the Hamas attack to the ongoing war in Gaza.
In this episode, we focus on the first 3 months of the conflict. The Hamas attack, the kidnapping of Israeli hostages taken into Gaza, followed by Israel's bombardment of the territory and the unprecedented humanitarian crisis.
In those 3 months, there was also a Gaza blockade by Israel. 20,000 Palestinians killed and widespread displacement of citizens. These horrific events were interspersed with brief moments of hope, with a temporary ceasefire and border crossing openings to allow humanitarian aid in and foreign citizens to leave. After the attack, Israeli observers grappled to make sense of it all.
The Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has ordered a complete siege on Gaza. Electricity, food, water and gas supplies have been cut off, while the Israeli army said it hit more than 500 targets in the blockaded and impoverished Gaza during overnight clashes, while fighting persisted in locations inside Israel. We're joined by Alan Shatter, former Minister for Justice and Defense. Speaking this morning about Saturday's events, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, who's a spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces, said that this is by far the worst day in Israeli history and that never before have so many Israelis been killed by one single thing on one day. Can I get your reaction, please, to what has happened?
Well, this is Israel's 9/11. What happened on Saturday was is best described as a horrific, barbaric atrocity. Over 700 people we know died on the Saturday. We now know there's over 800 Israeli casualties. This is reminiscent of the atrocities of Nazi Germany and pogroms of past centuries and the unbelievable atrocity of what occurred at a music rave. It should confirm to anyone who doubted it that Hamas is just the Palestinian version of ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Israel now has, I believe, no choice but to completely dismantle the terrorist military machine that Hamas has in Gaza, and that indeed of its Islamic Jihad allies, both of whom are sponsored by Iran.
So what do you think then about how Israel intends to go about doing that, trying to dismantle the Hamas terrorist regime in Gaza, and those comments from Israeli Defence Minister Yoav Gallant that he has ordered a complete siege on the Gaza Strip, that there'll be no electricity, no food, no fuel. He said everything is closed, we're fighting human animals and we will act accordingly. Now, of course, half the population there are children.
Look, the tragedy is none of this is necessary. Israel moved out of Gaza in 2005. I think, sadly and tragically, the Israelis have no choice but to engage in ground warfare. I don't think they can, and I don't think we politically tolerate it within Israel, to be left in a position whereby this type of event will be repeated endlessly. I think they have an obligation to defend their own citizens, to defend Israeli democracy, to defend all of every religion who live in Israel. And tragically, yes, there are going to be substantial casualties on both sides. I wish that wasn't the case.
The hostage families feared for the worst as the weeks went on.
21-year-old Almog Meir is one of the Israelis that were taken hostage by Hamas from the Supernova Desert Rave Festival. Almog rang his mother early on Saturday morning and told her that he loved her. Well, last Saturday at noon, Hamas released a clip in which several young men were seen beaten and terrified, and he hasn't been heard from since. His uncle, Avraham Meir, joins us now to tell us about what his family are going through.
It's a little problem. There is a siren here now. I hope I will be okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
I'm in a cemetery. There's a funeral of his friend that have been with him in the festival. It was his friend, and he was... I'm sorry, there's a siren now in Tel Aviv, and bombs are falling, and I'm outside.
Can you continue?
Just a minute. There is bombs all over, and I'm in Tel Aviv, yes?
Mm-hmm.
We just buried Tomer. Tomer is a friend of Almog. He have been announced as murdered yesterday night. After 10 days, he is the one who saw Almog last. And Almog is hostage, and Tomer is being buried now, right now, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the funeral now.
This must be an extremely difficult time for your family, Avraham, because...
My family is a small story here. It's a very, very difficult time to all Israel. All Israel, there's... a lot of suffer, and I'm in the families of the kidnapped group, and there are stories, horrible stories. Although he is kidnapped in Gaza, which is terrible to us,
mm-hmm.
but there are so many other terrible stories.
Could I ask you to tell me, from your perspective, the story of Almog and the story of the families whose people have been taken hostage?
I'll share it with you. Almog is 21 years old. It was for him the festival or the party.
The supernova
like
rave.
Was, yeah. Yes, it was for him like the party of the end of the summer, something like this.
Mm-hmm.
That it's the end of a period that he had lots of fun.
From Almog's perspective, then, or for your family's perspective, do you know where Almog is right now?
Gaza Street. This is what we know. I have nothing, we have no information. As far as I know, he is in a place that we don't know. Called his mother at about 7:45 a.m. He told her that there are rockets and shooting everywhere, and he don't know what's going on, and he loves her, and he will call her every half an hour. What we know afterwards, we know it from Tomer family, that I'm now in the funeral, that he entered Tomer's car and that they wanted to run away. Two girls, two sisters entered. They didn't know this, the sisters entered the car and they wanted to run away with the car. After about 50 meters, a bullet stopped them. The terrorists shot at them and they had to run from the car. What we know is that the two girls have been found murdered. Now we know that Tomer have been murdered and Almog have been captured. At about 1 o'clock in noontime, Orit got a telephone from Almog's friend. She recognized Almog in one of the videos. And when she shared the video, we knew it is Almog because it was him. There was no doubt about it. It was no hurt, but it was terrified.
Do you fear for Almog's life?
Of course.
As the Israeli army's heavy bombardment across Gaza continued, some seasoned observers in Israel feared that there would be no restraint.
Gideon Levy, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz and a member of its editorial board, joins us now from Tel Aviv in Israel. And you're very welcome, Gideon, to the programme this evening. We might start actually with what the situation is like in Israel today, because it has been, I can't imagine, a very difficult couple of days since Saturday, since Hamas launched the attack on Israel, multi-pronged attack that so far claimed more than 1,200 Israeli lives and then more than 1,000 Palestinians also being killed in retaliatory attacks.
It's a mixture of mourning, of being traumatized, of being shocked, because Israel was never facing such an attack. It never faced such a failure. And also with a big sentiment of the need to take revenge, the need to beat now the Hamas and Gaza and the Palestinians of Gaza. There is a lot of nationalism in the air, a lot of desire to punish Gaza, And it can lead us to quite bad places.
Because in Gaza, at least 1,200 people, including children, have been killed by Israeli military retaliation. Is that collective punishment by Israel a war crime in your view?
How else can you define it? But we are only in the beginning. I mean, if Israel will stop in the coming days, so I could understand it, you know, in a war, you behave like in a war. It was a barbaric attack on Israel with horrible scenes. But this doesn't mean that Israel has now a carte blanche to do whatever it wants. There should be limits, legal limits, moral limits. And watching the reports from Gaza makes me very, very worried, because I have the feeling, and everyone say that this is just the promotion, that's the promo. What's going to happen in the coming days is going to be much worse.
The health system was put under unbearable strain as the war dragged on and humanitarian aid dried up.
Al-Shifa is the biggest hospital in the Gaza Strip, and it's running out of space and fuel as victims of Israeli airstrikes arrive in a constant stream. Professor Ghassan Abu Sita is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon working in the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza.
So the Shifa hospital is Gaza's biggest hospital. It's a compound hospital made up of buildings. The grounds of the hospital have become like a tent or a shanty town. Tens of thousands have basically sought refuge in the hospital, hoping that it's a safe haven from the bombing.
Can you tell me about the amount of wounded and bodies that you received in about 24 hours? Because I heard you say 600 dead into the hospital in a day. Is that correct?
Yes. So the day before, there were 600 dead in the system, and everything is running short, including the fuel for the generator. The hospital is overwhelmed. The staff are overwhelmed. A lot of them have lost members of their family, or we've lost members of staff. We've lost a colleague, plastic surgeon. Last night, in the early hours of the night, one of our operating room staff are completely exhausted, just like the supplies. I mean, for the last hour, the building shaking with intense bombing.
Did you say that you have patients who have lost whole families?
Yes, there are lots of children who are the sole survivors of their entire family. My colleagues in other specialties tell me that they have the same whole families that are being wiped out when the building is being flattened. The day before, I had a 12-year-old told me that her mother and father had been killed. The day before that, I had a couple of children. Today, another boy whose parents were killed. And this is in a 17-day period. I mean, that's the killing machine that is been unleashed on the Palestinians in Gaza. You know, the system is within days of collapsing.
And there were some desperate stories of loss as the war intensified.
Khalid Al-Astal was born in Belfast. He spent his early years there attending primary school. So he's an Irish citizen, and when he was 8, he moved back to Gaza. He met his wife Ashwak in Gaza, and they have 2 children, Ali, who's 4, and Sarah, who's 1. Mr. Al-Astal is a graphic designer and had been working away from his family in Saudi Arabia for nearly a year. He had hoped to get home to the family in Gaza before the conflict broke out, but he arrived in Dublin Airport today. Ashwak died in hospital in Gaza on Wednesday from her injuries from an airstrike. Khalid now can't get to his children in Gaza. They remain in the care of their grandparents there. So he came to Ireland, and he spoke to me as he arrived in Dublin Airport just a couple of hours ago.
My name is Khalid Al-Astal.
Can you tell me a bit about your wife?
So she went to my family's house, and the exact day she was in my family house, they bombed the house, and my mom was killed immediately, and my brother the same. And she was burned 60% of her body, and she went to the hospital. She was in a very bad condition, but after like 4 or 5 days, her condition was getting a little bit stable. We was happy about that. And suddenly, before yesterday, she in 5 minutes she died. And I have 2 children. I have 2 children. I don't know.
Was she in Al-Shifa Hospital?
No. She was in Khan Yunis, in the south side of Gaza. It's supposed to be safe.
Do you know anything about what the conditions in the hospital were like?
It's awful. You know, they are making surgeries in the corridors. I swear to God, they are without. I know.
Anesthesia.
Yes, without anesthesia. They are, and there is a people who don't have any place to shelter or stay. They are staying in the corridors. My dad, he was staying on the floor. He don't have a home, and he was trying to help my wife. He's a professor, and he was sleeping on the floor all the time. And she passed away. She passed away.
Israeli parliamentarians believed they were justified in their methods as they battled Hamas.
Moshe Terpaz is also a member of the Israel-Ireland Parliamentary Friendship Group, and he visited the Erechtis last year. Since the Israel-Hamas war began on the October the 7th, he's also enlisted as a reservist officer in the Israeli army.
I'm talking to you not only as the deputy speaker of the Israeli parliament, but also as an officer in the reserves, Israeli reserves army. And I see every day the way Israel is fighting Hamas. Now, Hamas is using the houses of civilians, of innocent civilians in Gaza, in order to shoot Israel because he knows we are very careful not hitting innocent people in opposed to him. So he can shoot 1,000 missiles a day. Israel will try only to act against terrorists, and yet we are calling civilians in the Gaza Strip to leave their homes in order not to be innocently hurt. But yes, Israel, now we're making a great effect. We're doing great, a lot of work calling the civilians to leave their homes because the Hamas is using them. You can't say Hamas and people are hit from doing such things.
Notwithstanding all of that, Mr. Terpaz, since the 7th of October, nearly 6,000 Palestinians, 5,791 have been killed. And former US President Obama said many of them are children.
You can't only take the numbers and not see the whole picture. Israel has suffered a massacre of 2,000 or 3,000 terrorists who came into our land and killed innocent people just because they're Israelis. Again, Jews and Arabs. And then Israel is trying to hunt only the terrorists. Again, I can tell you from my own experience because I sit in the headquarters where decisions are made. And we are tens of times we didn't attack when we saw innocent people there.
Displacement orders, military bombardment, lack of humanitarian aid, along with closed borders, created severe problems for ordinary Gazans.
It's been reported this afternoon that up to 1 million people have been displaced on the southern fringes of Gaza in an attempt to escape the threat of an imminent Israeli invasion and air attacks. This is putting enormous pressure on the Palestinian territory, which is entirely closed off and spans only 25 miles long and 4 miles wide, with a population of more than 2 million. In particular, desperate civilians have been pouring into the town of Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. We managed to speak to a Palestinian-Irish man, Ibrahim Alaga, in Khan Yunis just a few minutes ago. Despite a shattered telecommunications system and widespread chaos there, Ibrahim is desperately trying to organise safe passage out of Gaza with his wife Amida and their three young children after they travelled over from Dublin to visit family members in June. Here's what he told me.
I'm an Irish Palestinian citizen. I came to visit my family here in Gaza a couple of months ago, and unfortunately situation got bad. I'm trapped here and I can't go back home. Right now I'm in the city of Khan Yunis, which is south of Gaza Strip. It's very bad in two ways. You can think of, first of all, there's bombing and explosions happening everywhere. You can hear it, and you can hear bombs coming down, and then just give it some seconds and see the smokes come. And then on the other side, we're also facing a very humanitarian problem where we don't have any, we're running out of food, we're going out of water. Electricity is very limited. We have a small solar system that we rely on for charging our phones, and very, very, very limited internet. So we're kind of disconnected from the world. We don't know what's going outside. And we keep on getting the news that there are some plans to provide some aid through Rafah border, but it's not happening.
There was a brief respite as the Rafah border gates were opened in November for some foreign citizens to leave.
You've heard in the headlines, 23 Irish citizens have crossed from Gaza into Egypt today. Taoiseach Micheál Martin told journalists in Cairo that an Irish diplomatic team was at the Rafah crossing and that they bring the group to Cairo. Just before we went on air, I spoke with the Taoiseach and asked him about the 23 Irish citizens who had escaped Gaza.
23 Irish citizens have crossed today. They're at Rafah right now on the Egyptian side and through. And we will bus them from there to Cairo. Our diplomatic team are on the ground there at Rafah. And then for onward transport to Dublin or wherever the citizens may wish to go. It is good news. And today I met with Foreign Minister Shoukry in Egypt and with the Secretary General of the Arab League, Abdel Gait. Tomorrow I'll meet with the Foreign Minister of Israel and the President of Israel and then with the Palestinian Authority to maintain our efforts to get the remainder of Irish citizens out also.
Because there's about 40 in total, is that it?
Yeah, well, it's a fluid situation and in terms of citizens and dependents, but so there will be another group to come out, certainly somewhere in around over 40. So we're continuing to work on that with the Israeli authorities in terms of finalising lists.
And relief too for Ibrahim Alaga.
We are now in Cairo. We're very happy. Children are having their breakfast now. It's a very strange feeling that they can eat and drink as much as they want today. So all good news.
Doctors were seeing things they never experienced before in their professional lives.
A British surgeon just back from a two-week stint at the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza says the situation at the facility has been beyond any doubt the worst thing he's seen in his career. As a clinical lead in the hospital, he detailed multiple traumatic amputations of children and horrific burns, the likes of which he's never seen before. Consultant surgeon Professor Nick Maynard is now back home in Oxford and he joins us now on the line. And Professor Maynard, you're very welcome to the programme this evening. You got to Al-Aqsa then, the main general hospital in the centre of Gaza. Can you talk us through what you saw there?
So Al-Aqsa is a small hospital in Gaza. I haven't worked there previously. I've worked in Shifa Hospital and other hospitals, but I've never been to Al-Aqsa Hospital. But it's a small hospital. It has a normal capacity of about 150 patients. And the capacity, when I was there for the 2 weeks, was over 700 at the time. So when we approached the hospital, the crowding was like nothing I've ever seen before. Many people have migrated to the hospitals in Gaza because they are considered to be safe areas. So they use the hospitals as shelters. So in the roads surrounding the hospital, there were many thousands of people who had moved there. And it was like a town had been built rapidly in the immediate surroundings of the hospital.
And of course, given what is going on in Gaza at the moment, the need for medical treatment has never been greater. You were there to conduct surgeries. Can you tell us about what injuries you were treating?
I was trained as a general surgeon. My main specialty is cancer surgery of the upper gastrointestinal tract. But I was effectively doing a lot of abdominal and thoracic trauma surgery when I was there. And there was another colleague of mine from London who was similar skill set. So we were doing a lot of abdominal operations for blast injuries from bomb injuries, essentially with shrapnel having gone into the abdomen and thoracotomies for chest injuries. And the shrapnel, which goes through the chest wall or the abdominal wall and just shreds the internal organs. So these were patients who were bleeding massively with in the chest, their lungs having been torn to pieces by the shrapnel, in the abdomen, all the intestinal, all the abdominal organs, the liver, the spleen, the intestines, the duodenum, all often shredded by the shrapnel. So they were very sick and they required very major surgery to sort out all the damage.
In terms of conducting that surgery, what facilities did you have available to you?
So we had a sort of previously a treatment room adapted into an operating theatre, and we had a fairly basic set of operation tools which were adequate, but we had to make do with a very limited supply of suture materials and needles, There were none of the luxuries that we're used to in England and Ireland of using devices for stapling guns to join bowel together again. We had to make do with a very basic set of surgical instruments. On one day, we had no running water in the operating theatre, so we couldn't scrub up. So we had to use alcohol gel to clean our hands.
What about pain relief?
So pain relief was often lacking. There are some days when there was no morphine, no strong painkillers. I was operating on adults, some men, a lot of young women. But in the emergency department, we saw a huge number of children as well, some as little as a few months old, with the most terrible burns. And you know, the burns I would never have wanted to have seen in my life, and the images which will be with me forevermore. A lot of traumatic amputations. I didn't operate on those. They were operated on by the orthopedic surgeons, but I saw a lot of these people coming in with legs having been blown off or arms having been burned off, often very small children. And as I said, the most shocking and appalling wounds, burns down to the bone. And sometimes there was no pain relief for these children. There was no morphine to give these children who had lost their legs or had these terrible burns. It was an apocalyptic picture, it really was.
We heard from Professor Ghassan Aboussita as he operated in Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza last year. What does he think now about the year of war in Gaza?
The place is a site of a humanitarian catastrophe. And what needs to be done is a proper ceasefire and for a proper humanitarian response that allows the rebuilding of the damaged homes and the treatment of the wounded.
Thank you for listening to episode 1 of Drive Time In Depth, The War in Gaza.
In the next episode, the death toll reaches 30,000. The war spreads outside Gaza and Rafah is targeted by the Israeli army.
The War in Gaza is produced by Drive Time series producer Will Hanafan and presented by me, Cormac O'Hara.
And me, Sarah McInerney.